You're listening to DraftKings Network.
This Friday, Boy Kills World. The must-see action movie event of the year hits theaters.
Yes! The Vanderkoys killed my family. Now, I'm gonna kill them one by one.
Critics are calling it Looney Tunes on acid.
You know how hard it is to get a cereal company to sponsor mass murder?
Weapons. Danger. Let's do this.
Bill Skarsgård in Boy Kills World. In theaters Friday. Rated R.
Now's a good time to remember where the story of tequila started. In 1795, the first tequila distillery was opened by the Cuervo family. And 229 years later, Cuervo is still going strong. Family-owned from the start, same family, same land. Now's a good time to enjoy Cuervo, the tequila that invented tequila. Go to Cuervo.com to shop tequila or visit a store near you. Cuervo, now's a good time.
Trademarks owned by Becle, SAB, the CV. Copyright 2024, Proximo. Jersey City, New Jersey. Please drink responsibly.
Hear ye, hear ye! The king has spoken.
And I'm not talking about Roy's Realm. I'm talking about LeBron James. On Wednesday afternoon, following the news that Kawhi Leonard would be out indefinitely with an ACL injury, LeBron James aired out some grievances on Twitter, saying essentially, "I told you so." In his Twitter thread, LeBron wrote that they didn't listen last year when he said, and I'm paraphrasing here, a shortened offseason due to the delayed bubble restart would cripple the league's stars. He noted that 8 and possibly 9 All-Stars are missing playoff games, if you include Chris Paul, who's in COVID-related protocols. That's the most in NBA history, which is actually a true thing. Shouts to LeBron, the researcher. LeBron went on to say, quote, "It's insane. If there's one person to know about the body and how it works all year round, it's me. I speak for the health of all our players, and I hate to see this many injuries this time of year. Sorry, fans. Wish you guys were seeing all your favorite guys right now." Prayer hands emoji, King's crown emoji, end quote. A lot to unpack here. First, the injuries have sucked. Like, really sucked. LeBron is right. This level of bodily carnage is unprecedented. Big names have been sidelined like Kawhi Leonard, Kyrie Irving, James Harden, Joel Embiid, Donovan Mitchell, Mike Conley, Jaylen Brown, Anthony Davis. These are the big ticket items that people come to see. And according to ESPN research, the previous high in NBA postseason history was 6 such injured All-Stars. 6. Think about that. If Chris Paul misses time, we're already 50% higher than the previous high mark. And we still have a month to go. And consider this, according to injury guru Jeff Stotts, who runs the most authoritative injury database in the NBA over at InStreetClothes.com, we've seen more postseason games lost due to injury by All-Stars than we did in the previous 2 postseasons combined. In fact, as recently as the 2013-2014 postseason, the one that Miami Heat fans would rather forget, All-Stars missed 0 playoff games due to injury that year. 0! And now we have as many as 9. So, like, can someone please entomb Giannis and KD and Ben Simmons in some bubble wrap, like, now? Now, you might be asking yourself, why so many injuries? We know where LeBron stands on this issue. He thinks it's because of the quick restart. According to Elias Sports Bureau, the Lakers and the Miami Heat had the shortest offseason, 71 days, in the history of the 4 major American sports, NHL, NFL, MLB, NBA. That hasn't happened. And sure enough, LeBron, AD, and the Lakers couldn't catch up. They crumbled under the weight of the schedule this year, and the Miami Heat didn't fare well either. So you can see why LeBron feels a certain way about the restart. Big picture, LeBron is onto something. I've been hammering this point for a while now, and it feels good that LeBron is now speaking my gospel, which is this. The NBA schedule cannibalizes its stars. The reward for the best teams with the star players that go deep in the postseason, the ones who put more miles on their tires than anybody else? Yeah, congratulations! You get the shortest offseason and recovery period in the league! Start next season playing catch-up! And that's just the beginning. NBA stars travel more miles than any other star in sports. Oh, and you need recovery days to heal that wear and tear and fatigue? We're gonna punish your team if you do that. Yes, the NBA has rules against DNP rest days. The schedule is effing grueling. It's habitual 3 a.m. hotel arrivals and long road trips that can make your head spin. When LeBron got hurt in March, he was in the middle of a 5-game in 7-night stretch, a dizzying gauntlet that the NBA had eliminated in recent seasons because it was too demanding. But this season, well, gotta get the games in. The schedule is madness. I literally had a Spurs trainer tell me once that he used to write his hotel room number in Sharpie on his forearm because he couldn't remember which city or hotel he was in at the time, much less his room number. And if you hang around NBA staffers long enough, you'll hear tons of stories like these. But here's the tricky thing. In LeBron's Twitter missive, he said, quote unquote, they didn't listen when he warned about the consequences of a fast-tracked offseason. Who is they that LeBron is talking about there? Is it the owners? Is it Adam Silver in the league office? Or is it, gasp, his fellow players? Because remember, Adam Silver can't unilaterally choose a start date. That's collectively bargained with the players' union. And the players' union president is Chris Paul, fellow banana boater and godfather of LeBron's firstborn son. So if LeBron truly has a problem with the system, that's something to take up with Paul and his fellow players. Because nothing gets done without the sign-off of the NBPA. The system is set up this way because, let's be honest, it makes a shit ton of money for the players and owners. But the more that broken bodies start piling up and becoming the story, fans will likely tune out the NBA and turn on the Netflix. By the way, I just finished Peaky Blinders. Long live Tommy Shelby. Anyway, if the system unfairly taxes the LeBrons, the KDs, and the Kawhis of the league, then those guys need to huddle up and figure out how to correct it. In other words, the king doesn't have to hold court with Twitter. He has to hold court with his peers. For MetalArk Media, I'm Tom Haberstroh.
I know he's on holiday, but...
Love a good holiday.
Love a good holiday, yeah.
What? Oh, vacation.
No. You have it right, John. So is vacation not a word that's used by English people or
no.
it's just
in any sense?
It's just,
what was the first one you said?
There's no other added context?
No, it just feels overly elaborate.
So like Rugrats Vacation is called like Rugrats Holiday in Britain?
We may have stepped outside of my expertise area here.
How about like Christmas Vacation, the Chevy Chase movies?
No, it's Christmas holiday.
Oh, is it really?
I'm
actually surprised by that. Like, I'm
Christmas
surprised.
Christmas
holiday.
Yeah, I don't know what to tell you. I've just finished having a fight with my publishers because they have made my book American. They have changed all the spelling to American.
Oh, so like favorite, they take out the U's.
Yes, they spell it wrong. Yes.
Yeah, no behavior.
John, before we get to the tomfoolery, let me ask you a question. Oh, okay. Who's the best James Bond?
Idris Elba.
Ooh, but he's not one yet. Who's the best one that's done it so far? Because I think Daniel Craig has been pretty good.
I mean, it depends how you like your low-grade misogyny and toxic masculinity kind of baked. If your idea of a man is someone who punches really hard and can take a punch, then Daniel Craig is amazing. If you like it, someone who's so emotionally broken that they can't forge even the remotest semblance of relationship with anybody. If you like your spies so that they yell that they're a spy to everyone who's listening and can be beaten by somebody who pops something in their martini, then Daniel Craig is brilliant.
I prefer
the old days of a bit of whimsy. And the idea that the whole franchise didn't take itself so bloody seriously. You know, the idea, if you're going to be ridiculous and have a spy who announces to everybody, by the way, hi, yes, I'm a secret spy, then why not just do it with tongue in cheek? So stick to the people who did it that way.
You'd like Naked Gun.
Yeah.
I do
it's
like
smart.
It. Yeah.
It's exactly
my kind. That's my speed.
So you're saying that a spy being whipped in the testicles for no apparent reason is not exactly your idea of James Bond?
The whole thing is so ridiculous. You know, I can't talk about it, but we know better.
He's rattled.
It's too late. We've been taping everything you're saying. So what do you mean?
You're already
talking about it. So go ahead. And I believe there was a very good reason that somebody was whipped in the testicles, if I'm not mistaken. I don't believe it was inexplicable, but go ahead and unspool that thought before we get into the serious subject matter and your book, by the way, which I want to talk to you about.
Thank you. So, I mean, I think the thing for me, torture is a far more sophisticated thing than simply nailing someone in the nads. It always has been and always will be. And I've never understood the idea. If you want compliance from somebody, I mean, there's a reason psychologists are not allowed to be, according to the, if you want to keep your license, we're not allowed to be involved in torture for very good reasons, because there are simpler ways of extracting information from people than nutting them, right? It's just that there are better ways than that. And that not visually pleasing, that's for sure, but better.
Guillermo, put it on the poll, please. Is torture a more sophisticated thing than nailing someone in the nads? Yes or no?
I'm going to vote on that one.
At Levitard Show. Your book, John, everyone loves hearing from you around here. You have a way of talking about things in a way that is sort of measured and unarguable when you make your points and your tone doesn't get in the way. The need to write another book. What are you trying to accomplish with that? And tell the people where it is and how it is they could get it.
Yeah. So they've done this weird staggered thing where The Promises of Giants is available for pre-order now in the United Kingdom, but not available in America until November or something. I don't know. I can't explain it. The wisdom of other people. In terms of why write the book, I mean, every time we talk, Dan, every time we talk, essentially what we're talking about is the vacuum of leadership. Whatever problem or challenge we are discussing is wrought from an absence of leadership, and not just named leaders, not just like the president or a senator or a business leader, but the idea that individual people have been told for so long that they are inconsequential, that their voice doesn't matter, they can't make a difference, that they've started to believe people. And there's a leadership void. We need people who can help make our world better. And not everybody was blessed with having a mother as good as mine. And so I am trying to make it so that wisdom that has been passed down to me from my mother, from other people who I've met and have learned from in my life can be distilled into a book. And the usual me, right? So yes, there's some geekery. Yes, there's some science, but mostly it's stories, because I think that's the way we've been conveying important information since we lived in caves. So I'm just hoping it'll help people find their inner giant, realize that whoever they are, in whatever context, you have something to offer. You have a uniqueness that we really need.
What is the inspiration behind it? Because writing is difficult, and it is much easier to just go on Twitter or just grab a microphone and let your thoughts go. Why? What's the inspiration?
This was not a labor of love. I just want to point that out there right now. I have hated this book for the last 2 years, and only now am I beginning to build a relationship with it again. The inspiration for it is, I am tired of people being told that they aren't enough. I'm tired of people being told that they aren't the right kind of person to lead or make a difference. I think there are amazing ways to be authentic and authentically you and still make a difference. And there are some changes required. There's some challenges to meet. The book is called The Promises of Giants because there are 14 promises, 14 things that people have to think about if they want to make a difference. Starting with introspection, the idea that you have to look at yourself and know yourself, and then moving all the way through to interpersonal, how you interact with other people, skills, abilities you need there, and then organizational, whether that's a community or a business or politics, how do you navigate that and not be, how do you influence the culture and not be consumed by it?
Why was it not a labor of love? Beyond writing is hard.
Because I'm lazy. Because fundamentally, I am lazy. And this has been every weekend, pretty much, for the last 18 months. So I knew the value of it. At least I knew what I was trying to do with the value of it. People will determine the value of it themselves. But there's a point where you start to resent the blank page in front of you. You're a journalist. You know from your early days, sometimes it isn't where you want it to be. And then you've got to match this expectation that people have when they hear you talk. And for some reason, I'm better when just asked a question randomly than when I sit down and try and write something that makes sense as a narrative. But I'm hoping that I've got a balance here of weird, tangential stories and geekery.
One of the reasons that I wanted to talk to you here is because last week we were having a conversation, or maybe 2 weeks ago, where I was talking specifically, John, about your and my experience, and the audience has gotten to know you. And I was talking about how difficult it is for an athlete in his prime, even now, Pride Month and everything else, and in America and a world that has seen some progress, how hard it was for even you. I thought that you were going to be, during your playing career, a spokesman and an advocate who, with uncommon strength, about being gay in male-dominated sports and toxic masculinity that you find in male locker rooms. And I was trying to explain to Stu Gatz why it is that not even you could summon the strength, when I think of you as someone with uncommon strength, to do that during your playing career. And I didn't have a way of expressing that to him from your perspective. So whatever it is that you can offer us on that front in terms of illumination, they're still making fun of me for not realizing that you were gay when we were in a gay nightclub.
I did wonder about that. I did wonder. For someone so acute, you missed that one. So why not? There are a number of reasons. Some of them were quite pragmatic. I knew that it would be very challenging as people gleefully point out, and a very average NBA player, to maintain my position as an out gay player. I knew that would be difficult. I knew from conversations that I had with the president of the Magic, for example, or with a number of people at the Utah Jazz, that their understanding of my queerness was unwelcome. And so I knew that it would cause a direct challenge there. And I knew that I wasn't going to have the supportive back office, the supportive necessarily, certainly not coaching staff in some places. In terms of the teammates, I just would point out that in terms of the teams themselves, that is, although there were indiscreet and hurtful comments made, they were not at me or around me. They were directed towards me, even though they did wound. But the locker rooms themselves, I rarely describe locker rooms as places that are toxically masculine. If you spend any time in a locker room at all, you realize it is the kind of last bastion of intimacy for men. In the best possible way, right? In the non-sexual kind of just intimacy, the place where you can cry, the place where you can talk, the place where you can share your worries and concerns. At its best, that is what a locker room can be. So I was less concerned about my teammates and more concerned about whether I could keep my job or not.
You thought it would be career-ending.
I didn't think it would. I knew it would. I had enough conversations with people who, especially, apparently I became more obviously gay to people over time. The English accent didn't fool people forever. apparently wearing bangles is a dead cert. Yeah, definitely gay. That and, I don't know, was it tongue rings? I don't know. I don't have one of those. So when that became something, I ended up sitting in rooms with people having conversations that were essentially along the lines of never talking about it, but just making it clear that we're a family organization. And I don't know if you've read my 16 books that I've written about values and how organizations have to be driven by values, and we wouldn't want anything unsavory. And you have a couple of those conversations and you realize that in the scheme of things, you are ultimately replaceable. And you can either be a martyr, or a momentary flash, or you can stick around and hopefully make a long-term difference.
I thought we were headed toward breakthrough on this front with Jason Collins and Michael Sam, but it has gotten quiet in the last couple of years when it comes to progress. And I'm not sure that sports is a great deal safer an environment now for a man in team sports, American team sports, to do this. Is it? Because
It is for the players in the locker room. So there are a number right now of out male athletes in the major team sports who they are out to their teammates, they are out to at least some of front office, they are out to coaches. Not all teammates necessarily, but many. There are quite a few now who are out in that way. And I just want to put that in perspective for people who don't know any gay people. That is the way that most gay people are out. They aren't necessarily, hi, I'm John, I'm gay, is not necessarily the first sentence that one delivers. So they're out to people they give a damn about and who think might give a damn about them. And so you earn that disclosure. That's the point of disclosure. People get disclosure wrong all the way. I know I've ranted about this before, but people do get it wrong when it comes to coming out. People think that when someone comes out to you, when I say I am gay, what I am doing is telling you something about me. But Dan, when I told you what you perhaps still fail to understand and what people listening will fail to understand is I was not making a statement about me. I was making a statement about you. I was making a statement that I have seen you. I have heard you. I have watched how you behaved. And I believe this most precious thing that is potentially dangerous to my career is something I can give to you with safety. That is what disclosure is, whether you're coming out about your religion, about your dyslexia, about your neurodiversity, whatever it is. When you share something with somebody else, it is a statement, a profound statement about the person you're sharing with.
You mentioned organizational values, and over the last year, I have been bothered. I've been actively bothered by corporations, the way that they have just been just blowing with the wind in terms of, and the NFL is guiltier of this than just about anybody. The idea that, hey, never mind, we were wrong about the whole Kaepernick thing. So when you talk about organizational values, I don't expect that from my corporations. I expect them to simply lie to me to continue their commerce.
I agree. I think lying to people is du jour, especially where it comes to the NFL. I mean, their duplicity is, even for me, words fail me. I don't have a qualifier big enough. But the idea that they can be supporting Black Lives Matter at this stage after constructively dismissing someone who should have been working this whole time and then employing somebody who's my age to work, it just seems outrageous. That might be a slight exaggeration, but I believe that person is old. I don't know who it is. This is the surface level of my interest in sport that I can maintain. so yeah, I think you're right. You do expect people to lie, but values, if you state them as values, you expect them to be a little more congruent. You expect a set of behaviors and implications from those values. And that's why organizations are screwing up. They don't realize that although generalizations about generations are generally really poor, a sentence I very much enjoy saying, that one thing we can say about younger generations and increasingly our generation too, for the older people in the room, is that we are increasingly sensitive to incongruence. We would much rather somebody come up to our face and yell the N-word, for example, then someone shake your hand and smile and then do it behind our back. The incongruence is what is causing. And organizations, we are working with multinationals right now who are struggling because they cannot find talent to stay simply because they've read their website and it says you're this kind of organization. They show up and it's something completely different. And the gap is what drives them, not the narrative itself.
I remember still being stunned, John, at your reaction after Tim Hardaway came on our show and said flatly, I hate gay people. And then I called you and was like, what is your reaction to this? And yours, it was almost ebullience. It was almost joy. You're like, finally, someone just said it out loud. Finally, no more camouflage and no more lying. You gave voice to it and you said it. I was stunned at the time by your reaction to that because you were grateful that Tim Hardaway's homophobia had been put out in public.
Yeah, it is useful to know the target you're trying to hit, right? It's useful to know the location of the enemy. We've been playing battleships and people had just been lying about where their ships were. And finally, someone just said, here I am, and I hate you. And all of a sudden, you can respond to this in a way that doesn't have people saying, well, no, I'm not saying I hate gay people. I just don't think gay people should ever hold hands in public. No. I'm not saying I hate gay people, but they probably shouldn't be allowed around children. Instead, it was someone who just said the words, not varnished with bullshit about religion, not varnished with nonsense about values and family values, just the truth.
Meech, I want to ask you, because I used to have this attitude towards racism, right? I'd rather someone come out and be outwardly racist to me and I know who my enemy is than to smile in my face and then, you know, do things behind my back. And then 2016 happened and I realized a lot more people are a lot more racist than I originally anticipated. How do you reconcile that with now many of these people are brazenly, where they would have been ashamed and hiding in their caves and not wanting to show their true prejudiced colors. Now they are brazen about letting you know exactly how prejudiced they are towards different races, different sexual orientations, et cetera.
So I still prefer to know that 70 million people still voted for a man who is a xenophobic, racist, misogynist. Other words, I still prefer to know because now nobody can lie. We can't pretend that the country is progressive. We can't look around and say that values that we thought enshrined now, earned, enshrined, amended, are safe, because they are not safe. But I think what's interesting, I mean, is that even with these people who say things that are blatantly racist, weirdly, the Daily Show, I don't know the name of the correspondent, but there's a correspondent for the Daily Show who goes to these rallies and tall white gentleman and talks to these people. He elicits from them broad racism to have it followed up by, I'm not racist. So I think what's interesting is now, while we are in this place where people are overtly racist, they are more vociferous in their denial of their racism. And that's what makes this such a dangerous time, where people can at once be vehemently, vociferously racist and deny, with the backing of pseudo-credible people, that they're racist, allowing it to perpetuate.
You are a clinical psychologist and you have used your powers in the corporate sphere to help companies be better about all of this stuff. How much resistance do you receive? How much do corporations actually want to be about values as you're demanding values from them?
The thing is, so highly resistant all the way through to a door waiting to be pushed open. I am not insisting on values. I probably would not have been the person to design websites to have pages and pages of flowery rhetoric describing the warm fuzzies that you'll get when you come into this company and then work 14 hours a day. But since people are doing that, what I'm suggesting is that in order to maintain congruence and have people want, under the age of 50, want to work for you for more than 18 months, you might want to deal with the implications of those values. You know, when you write on your website, your manager will take an interest in your career. When you write on your website, we celebrate pride, you are telling your staff members, whether they be based in Saudi Arabia or Indiana or London, you are telling them that you can come to work and feel safe, and your boss and your peers will not make fun of you. And if they do, there will be a sanction. So there's implications for these promises. So my job is to help people get as close as possible to their promises or reduce their promises so that the gap is smaller.
What is an organization's responsibility? What is a corporation's responsibility in your view? They've hired you, and they've hired you for specific reasons.
So do you mean their responsibility to their colleagues, to their employees?
Yes.
To create an environment where every single person knows that every single day they will be challenged to deliver their very best. There will be moments where they will be stretched beyond the point where they thought they could possibly deliver, but they will never be broken. They will never be put in a position where damage, trauma is inflicted on them. They will be in a position where managers care, have empathy for. This is not about effusive kind of rolling words. This is about the idea that as a human being, beyond a job description, your manager sees you. This is the responsibility of organizations, because the organizations want to win and I want to win. I'm not a soft touch. I'm not interested in warm, fuzzy moments or sitting around a campfire making s'mores. I want to win. And if you want to win, you create an environment that people never want to leave. And you do that by creating connections with people so that, let's face it, not everybody on your staff gets to do the sexy, exciting stuff. More so on your staff than most others, because frankly, half the people on the screen would never be seen in other shows. But most organizations, the essential work is so boring and so onerous and so repetitive that it's impossible to be connected to it in any authentic way. So what you have to do is have managers and leaders for whom that work is so important, but connect themselves legitimately to employees so that even if the work is boring, the work is important to this manager is important to me, therefore the work is important to me. That's just, it's called identified regulation. It's a theory of motivation. It's boring, but this is how we work.
We ask you to support the people who support us. Amici has been doing that for a long time. The name of the book, The Promises of Giants. You should seek it out and find it because there's wisdom all over the place when John Amici is speaking or writing. We will get you out on this one. No Stump the Meech this time because Stu Gatz has not been as incompetent as usual, though very incompetent. You like what best about your book? What is it that you find yourself proud of?
What I like best about my book is that you will meet my mother. When you read my book, she is the kind of person, though long gone, that when she talks to you, it's like she illuminates your brain. And people who read my book will get to meet her.
She told you on her deathbed, right? I have not had a fun life, but I have had a full life.
Yep. I've had probably more fun than she did, but full is still the important part.
John, always good catching up with you, buddy. Thank you for making the time.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you, guys.
This Friday, Boy Kills World. The must-see action movie event of the year hits theaters.
Yes! The Vandercoys killed my family. Now, I'm going to kill them one by one.
Critics are calling it Looney Tunes on acid.
You know how hard it is to get a cereal company to sponsor mass murder?
Weapons. Danger. Let's do this.
Bill Skarsgård in Boy Kills World. In theaters Friday. Rated R.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.